You know our slogan around here is better practice, better life. But we're taking this belief to the next level. And we've recently announced the creation of a new association. It's called the Best Practices Association. Our association celebrates the mindset that is better practice, better life. This mindset celebrates time, healthy living, personal growth, clinical excellence, and impacting the lives of your patients and your team through intentional leadership. In fact, we are the work-life balance experts in dentistry. The BPA will coach independent dental practices like yours to thrive by sharing best practices and operational habits, behaviors, systems, tools, and insight that lead to profitability and sustained growth, and you can still have a life. So if you're a dentist that wants to surround yourself with great thinkers, let us help you create your own version of better practice, better life. Go to actdental.com/BPA or hit the link in the show notes. Hey guys, you're watching the Best Practices Show, where we take a look at the best business practices from the best dental practices all across the country. And I've got a major treat for you. One of the best teachers, instructors, mentors I've ever had in my entire life, Dr. John Cranham from the Dawson Academy. And we're going to be talking about one of those subjects that everybody has struggles with, is why some of these challenging patients can be the keys to your success. So you are not going to want to miss this. So do me a favor, grab a pen and hit the share button. We'll see you in a second.
The Best Practices Show with Kirk Barrett is brought to you exclusively by ACT Dental, the ultimate provider of dental practice management solutions for dentists and their teams. ACT Dental is committed to helping you build a better practice and a better life. If you are looking to grow your production, motivate your team, get back on track, and create the practice you've always dreamed about, look no further. Give us a call at 800-851-8186 or visit us at actdental.com.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Best Practices Show, and I've got a huge treat for you today. So super, super fun stuff. And we're going to dig deep into the big challenging subjects that you have every single day. Sometimes you have these patients, and building a high quality restorative practice, everybody thinks it's super easy and you can just do it all the time. But there are some huge challenges that come with getting better. And I've got the guy, the main expert, to go right into the face of this storm and talk about the reality of it. My good friend, Dr. John Cranham. Now I'm going to do my intro before I get him to talk, because I think this is crazy important. If you're a young dentist watching this, one of the things that's critically important to your success in the future is you have to pick really good people to be your mentors. And what's changed now more than ever is that you have to go get your mentors. Mentors don't find you, you find them. So I'll tell you the story behind this guy. In 2004, I'd heard about him. I'm like, I've heard about that guy. I heard about him again and again and again. And finally, in 2005, I said, I'm just going to get to know this guy and he's going to mentor me. And I just emailed him and stalked him basically and told him that we're going to be friends. And he's like, I'll decide that type of a thing. So he was speaking to Traverse City, Michigan. I said, I'm just going to go. So I flew all the way up there, got there early in the morning, like before he even did. So I was sitting in a car in the parking lot. You know, as you can imagine, speaker shows up and there's somebody like that could be a little freaky at times. But I said to myself, I'm going to get to know this guy. And it was a day that changed my life forever, because I got to get inside the mind of a super high quality restorative dentist. And we've been friends ever since. So, John, thank you so much for being on, brother. I really, really appreciate it.
No, it's exciting. And I like the topic today. And you did scare me a little bit that first morning. But we have been good buddies since. And you have mentored me as much as I've mentored you. So it's been a very good relationship for sure.
Well, I appreciate that, brother. So just a couple things. Now we're shooting this live on Facebook. So if you're watching this either during the live broadcast or even after, please type in the questions. And I'm going to give those questions directly to John, or I'll ask John to respond to them later, because I want those questions to be answered. And we're going to go heavy into this subject, because everybody thinks this is super easy, just creating a high quality restorative practice. But the truth of it, it's not. And even your own journey has had a lot of challenges. I want to know your story, because maybe somebody watching this doesn't know. You actually slept in your car. You were so broke, you slept in your car to go to Seminar One. Is that true?
Well, yeah. And I think that it's interesting, but I think everybody sort of thinks about a dentist of where they are now. And so I think sometimes people come to lectures and they see the kind of dentistry that I'm doing, and they think it's sort of always like that. And my story is I bought a practice right out of dental school. The biggest year that that previous dentist had was like $110,000. I think he did 4 crowns the entire year before I bought the practice. And we had an autoclave, but the only thing that worked on it was the bell. The instruments weren't actually getting hot. So it was a humble, scary place. But my break was I had restored my mother's mouth in dental school. And a dentist that I was working with, a part-time faculty member, gave me Dr. Dawson's book right after my junior year and told me I needed to read it in the summer. And then we could follow those procedures and protocols my senior year. And so we did that and got out of dental school and met a lab technician in the Virginia Beach area. My office happens to be attached to their lab now. So we've been friends and worked together all since that time. But he told me about Dr. Dawson's courses and said he would pay for me to go to the first seminar because I had just bought this practice and was completely broke. And, you know, I finished up on a Wednesday afternoon at 5 o'clock and drove my little Toyota Tercel to St. Pete and got there about 4 in the morning before the seminar. And so it really wasn't time to get a hotel. So I kind of slept out in front of the Don Cesar and worked good the first night. So I just slept in my car the rest of the night and showered by the pool. But you know, Don Cesar was like $280 a night, and that was 1989, and that was a lot of money. And I just heard Bruce Springsteen like 3 weeks before and slept in my car to hear him. So Springsteen, Dawson, they're both rock stars.
Hey, absolutely. Now, for somebody that doesn't know who Pete Dawson is, I mean, maybe they were sleeping under a rock. You are now part owner of the Dawson Academy. And take us through that whole journey. So you took the courses. What happened after that?
So what was interesting is 89, 90, when I took all of Pete's classes, at that time was just the beginning of sort of the aesthetic revolution. IPS Empress hit the market. Cosmetic dentistry was just sort of beginning. And I did my first 4 or 5 years really focused on occlusion and TMJ, some of the things we're going to talk about today. And what I noticed, Dr. Dawson had stopped practicing in 1989. And so it's weird to think about it now, but there were two, cosmetic dentistry and occlusion, you know, functional dentistry was like diametrically opposed with each other. And about 94, I wanted to start doing beautiful dentistry. So I went to my first AACD meeting was in San Juan, Puerto Rico, like 93, 94, 95, somewhere in there. And I went there because I wanted to go to Puerto Rico, didn't expect to learn a lot, honestly. And what I saw was some of the most beautiful dentistry I'd ever seen. But I also recognized some of the fathers of cosmetic dentistry really didn't know a lot about occlusion. And so my vision at that time was to blend cosmetic dentistry with the principles that Dr. Dawson had taught me. And so by about 98, I had a lecture called The Cosmetic Occlusal Connection, which is what you heard. Mm-hmm. And that's what sort of got it going, was a lecture where they could hear both things in the same place. And as you know, I tend to like to be a little edgy on some of these things. So that's what got it going. And 03, I was speaking in Tampa, and the story is kind of cool because I was setting up for about 50 dentists and Pete Dawson walks in. And so he kind of comes to scout me. You know, Pete's so humble, he didn't think anybody would like notice, you know, and the room went dead quiet when he walked in. But anyway, he heard me. We had dinner that night and invited me to come in and start being a part of Seminar 2. And I became clinical director in, I think, 06 and a partner in 08. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's been the great joy of my life to be with him and now taking this information all over the world.
Yeah. And the Dawson Academy is a crazy special place. I was fortunate enough to be with you guys a couple of weeks ago. We had the Dawson alumni retreat and just some of the most special people from all over the world. And obviously Pete being one of the original stewards of that whole entire community, really, really sweet people. And I remember at the age of 24, that was one of the first courses I took, was a top 10 course. And Pete said some things to this day that I remember so clearly. He always said things like, don't focus on the money. The money's the byproduct, doing the right things with the right people. And you can see why these core value principles have been so strong. And he's just been a great influence like you have now.
And they're enduring. Those principles are enduring for sure.
They are. I love how you love to just fly in the face and be a little bit controversial, because that cosmetic occlusal connection, that was almost like blasphemy. Like, how could you even put those two things together?
Yeah.
And people would show up in droves. I mean, there had to be 300 people at that lecture I went to, because they wanted to know, how are you going to put these two things together?
That's right. And I do think that it's amazing now to look at it, because just from a patient's perspective, who wants a beautiful smile that falls apart, and who's going to spend $30,000 or $50,000 on a reconstruction that looks ugly? Right. So, you know, our patients want it to look beautiful. They want it to speak well so they can talk and get their lips together, and they want it to last. So these are things that we have to master. We have to master smile design and all the procedures that go along with that. But we also have to be able to make occlusion stable and have protocols and workflows that get that done.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you were really one of the first original people that helped me understand the brain of a great restorative dentist. Number one, you're a great educator. The thing that I learned, though, too, was I thought a master restorative dentist had a whole week of just full mouth and quadrant dentistry. And then you described the concepts of, you know, you got aerobic days and then you have other days. And there's days you got to do the buckle pit type of a thing. You taught me back then in 2005. And this topic is so critical that we're talking about today, the challenging patient, because you don't have patients that are just lining up with checks saying, hey, I've been waiting for this. I'm ready. Let's do the whole thing. Can you just, I want to do the whole upper, the whole lowers, and can we do it right away? I'm ready to go. That's not the truth of what happens in your practice, is it?
Well, I think the greatest thing for dentists to understand, and I do think that that concept of aerobic days and what we would call specialty days, days where we're focused on the patients that do have more complex needs and the want and desire to fix those needs. That's the other part of it. What we do is we define a general patient as really a patient that doesn't have anything systemically wrong with their mouth. They don't have wear, they don't have loose teeth, they don't have TMJ problems. They're pretty happy with how their teeth look. So I would call a general patient sort of our bread and butter, nuts and bolts patient that comes in and gets their teeth cleaned and maybe needs a single crown or a bridge or an implant, but we're not having to redesign anything. You know, we're accepting their occlusion for what it is. And to be clear, it has nothing to do with pocketbook. It has nothing to do with, well, really what the patient expectations are. It's that they lack occlusal disease and they lack the desire to change anything aesthetically. They're just trying to maintain their teeth and health and function for the rest of their life. And if they have a dental problem, it is either a biologic problem like caries or gum disease, or they have maybe some structural problems with individual teeth that we can go ahead and deal with without having to change their bite. So I would say in my practice, you know, there's going to be a percentage of my population of patients that's like that. And I would also submit that that population we were taught to deal with in dental school, because we're taught in dental school to basically build the bite back to what the patient walks in with. Now, the specialty patients, the patients that challenge us a little bit, are those patients who don't have a bite that's working for them. They've got evidence that their bite isn't stable. Their teeth are wearing. Their teeth are shifting positions or migrating, or their teeth are loose in the absence of gum disease. They may have muscle contraction, headaches, or problems in the joint, pain or degeneration in the joint. Those are the really challenging ones, because all we know for sure about those patients is what they presently have is not working. And so this is the thing, is that dentists, by and large, unless they go through some advanced training, they do not have a workflow to solve those problems. And when we deal with problems with teeth or muscles at the academy, we train our doctors to have a workflow to gather additional data that allows us to do occlusal design, to come up with an occlusal scheme that will work for those patients and manage the forces and decrease the stresses to the system, as well as smile design principles if the smile needs to be improved based on the patient's wants. What's so fun for me, my favorite thing to do, is that a lot of the patients that have unattractive smiles, when we evaluate the patients, they have unattractive smiles because of underlying functional issues. So Dr. Dawson's principles of occlusal design work so beautiful with the more contemporary smile design, because form follows function and function follows form. And so that's kind of one population. And the other population is when, under this specialty umbrella, is when the joint itself is not functional or is not functioning properly or breaking down. Because in that population, we have to get the joints stable first before we can even think about the occlusion, before we can even think about the teeth. Right. So I want you to think about sort of three workflows: the general patient, the specialty patient that has sort of problems with muscles or teeth, and then the specialty patients that have issues with their joints. And again, in my practice, what I try to first do is screen patients so I know what category they go in, so that we're treatment planning properly and getting enough data to make good decisions. And then, you know, I know what you do a lot with your clients is then help schedule accordingly. So when we're doing more general patients where we can go a little faster and have a little more going on, we have sort of afternoons or days like that. And during my specialty time, I typically am working on one patient for longer periods of time. And so that's the thing.
Right. Now, I want to go back to this because you used the word workflow. I love how you use that word, because one of the things you taught me and I've learned from Dr. Dawson and all the things that you teach at the Academy is predictability is the one thing dentists need more than anything to be happy. So describe, if somebody's watching this and they don't know what a workflow is, tell them what a workflow is.
So let's expand on predictability. I like to use the acronym PEP, which stands for predictability, efficiency, and profitability. And they all go together, PEP. So predictability, efficiency, and profitability. And what I want you to think about, maybe for the docs that aren't familiar with this concept, but let's say you take somebody that has occlusal problems, occlusal disease, and maybe it manifests itself as some wear. And maybe the patient is in the crown of the month club, meaning they keep popping cusps off teeth and they get the next crown and the next crown. When we think about those patients, sometimes they start doing to our crowns what they've been doing to their own teeth. So that creates a lot of stress in our practice, because all of a sudden we're doing work for patients that's not working very well. They're breaking stuff. We then have to redo it, and it's just not predictive. And I don't even think we even can wrap our head around what it costs the dental practice to go back in and redo things for free in terms of paying the lab bill again and redoing the work. I mean, even if you get the lab to do it over for free, which isn't fair to them, but if you do, going back in and spending all that time is a waste of time. So what a workflow is a series of procedures that once we recognize a problem, that will take us through a series of events. So when we get to the end, which is probably the final restorative steps of putting in the case, it's going to be right. Mm-hmm. It's going to be correct. So with somebody that has, say, problems with the muscles or teeth, all we really have to do in that scenario is do all our normal things that we would do, oral cancer check, check the gums, check the teeth for caries. But we're also going to expand what we do in terms of evaluating the aesthetics of the situation and the occlusion. So typically, we're going to add some photographs. We're going to add a face bow, a centric bite record, and mount some models, and then have a more detailed treatment planning time away from the patient so we can actually design something that's going to be stable following Dr. Dawson's principles. So that three-dimensional visualization is a huge part of what we do for dentists, is teaching them some key principles and competencies and best practices, if you will, of how to design something so when they start working with the patient, the very first thing they're going to do beyond getting the gums healthy and getting rid of the decay is also get the bite stable. And so we're going to get that bite stable before we start doing the restorative work. And we might be adjusting the bite. We might be moving some teeth first. We might put in some provisionals first and work out the bite and the provisionals. But we're not going to start sending it to the lab until we've proven that things are going to be rock solid and stable and the patient's happy with aesthetics. The problem with doing everything in the patient's habitual bite, when the bite's not working, as soon as we cut the teeth down, often the bite starts changing and the muscles get sore, and then the case is going back and forth to the lab from the doctor. And, you know, the doctor is staring at the ceiling in the middle of the night worrying about the case, and that's no fun. If we've been practicing dentists long enough, we've all had cases go like that. But the more predictive we can be, the happier that we can be, the more we can get out at 3 o'clock when we're doing the straight eight, like you taught me, and the more we enjoy what we're doing and the more profitable we're going to be.
Absolutely. And along this path, this is so important, the way you guys teach workflows, because everyone thinks, well, when we get to the three categories, you're talking about specialty patients with joints, everybody thinks, oh, that's the fun stuff. It's easy. That's where you really make the profit. But these patients come in with higher expectations.
That's true. But when we think about the title of this, I think sometimes these specialty patients can be draining. I think with where we are right now in dentistry, I think a lot of these patients are starting to figure out when they are in a practice that is more volume oriented, they don't necessarily fit there. So I do find one of the best opportunities we have in dentistry today is being able to solve these type of problems that we're talking about, particularly the occlusal problems that related to wear and broken teeth, and then these TMJ patients that get bounced around that nobody really wants to pay attention to. I tell you what, you solve somebody's TMJ problem, they'll never let another dentist anywhere touch them. I've got some right now that start to see me with more gray hair or less hair than I got brown or blonde hair. And, you know, they're worried about the retirement and they find out I have a daughter in dental school. And I think they think just because she has the same last name, she's going to come out of dental school knowing this. Well, she's going to have to learn all of this too. But the point is that these specialty people are looking for people who can solve problems beyond the usual and customary. And I think with where dentistry is going, it's ultimately going to be the decision of the dentist on whether they're going to learn to be able to solve these problems or not. I'm becoming convinced you can be in a variety of environments and learn to do it. You don't necessarily have to be just in a solo practice. That's certainly a vehicle. But for sure, if you want to be a little more independent from insurance, and if you want to are trying to maintain some of that fee-for-service model, these patients are willing to pay to have problems solved, aesthetic problems, bite problems, TMJ problems, multiple missing teeth implant type solutions. These are things that in the patient's mind are beyond usual and customary.
Right.
So I think more than ever before, it's critical to have these skills to be able to do that. And that's where the opportunity lies.
Yeah. So let's talk about that opportunity too. So let's say I'm a 32-year-old dentist and I'm watching this. And I go, John, that sounds awesome. You've done so much. Like, where do I even start? Because I have a lot of insurance in my practice. I want to start solving some of these problems. And when you talk about why challenging patients can be the key to our success, I mean, I've got challenges everywhere. So let's go into that. Where would you start? And what are some of the challenges you see that are opportunities with these patients?
Well, the kind of patients that we're talking about, if you're sort of a 30-year-old dentist and you're in a scenario where 85% of what you're doing is insurance dependent, a lot of people feel so locked in. But, you know, I think back of how I started, there was some of that. Everybody was worried about managed care at that time. So it's funny, 20 years later, we're still kind of worried about it. But my biggest thing was I had this whole group of patients that didn't value anything beyond just huge fillings and teeth. And we had the cheapest fees in town in my little practice. And so it still was an educational process where we had to start educating patients on some of the more global things that were going on in their mouth and really getting from the patient that they had a desire to keep their teeth in health and function for the rest of their life. And maybe finding the patients that had a desire to have a better smile. So I think if you're that 30-year-old doctor, the first thing you have to do is with the entire team, start to screen for some of these patients and develop a protocol where you can talk to patients about things beyond just what's hurting them, you know, just the hole in their tooth or the broken cusp, the stuff that is kind of self-aware. We have to have ways to build value for something that is going to be more helping keep their mouths healthy for their life. And so there isn't any way around the fact that that takes some education. But I think what's key to understand is it doesn't necessarily have to be only the dentist that's talking about that. Hygienists can play a huge role. So maybe as the leader of the team, we've got to get them all on the same page and get them excited about this next level of care. I think also the way out of insurance is still solving the problem. So it may be initially that you're going to have to do some of this dentistry at fees that you don't necessarily want to do it at. But if you signed up for those plans, that's what it is. And we've talked about this, that when you're getting rid of insurance, you just don't want to go in one day and quit everything. You've got to create a strategy to gradually get away. And what I would say is you first get the procedures and these protocols on the shelf and you get the team aboard of what you're going to do. And once you start having some success, you start having some photographic evidence of success and some testimonials, then as you start getting a little bit more known for that, which might take 18 months or something like that, then you take the insurance company that's hurting you the worst and you drop that one.
Right.
And then you drop the next one. And for a lot of our doctors, we see very successful practices that even keep a couple of them that aren't hurting them that bad that they may feel a responsibility to accept. In our area, for instance, a lot of docs keep the insurance that's related to the military because they want to support the troops. And, you know, in Virginia Beach, we've got the naval bases and all that stuff. So that's a decision everybody's got to make. But the thing that we have to understand is whether the patient has insurance or not, we love it that the insurance patients only were general patients, but that's not how it works.
Right.
But the other thing to remember is insurance patients don't just know insurance patients. So when you solve people's more advanced problems, regardless of where they come, they talk.
Right.
And they provide you with photographic evidence and a story that you can put on your Facebook and on your website, and you can start attracting some of these patients with more complex needs. And then it gets fun because the truth of it is, a lot of doctors, if they could visualize a practice where the bills were paid and maybe their base salary was paid by their general practice, and these specialty patients became sort of the gravy on top of it, if you added four nice cases a month to what you're doing, you would significantly change the bottom line of your practice, because then it all falls to the bottom line minus the lab fee. And then that's nirvana.
Yeah. I love what you're talking about too, because sometimes as a young dentist, you just need a couple wins. You use the word, you've got the digital evidence, or you've got some type of a photographic memory that how do you get through this? And so if you're watching this, one of the things you might think about is that out of every challenge comes an opportunity. I want you to talk about one of your patients, and we'll give them a specific example because I've heard this story. Is you had a patient named Dot. This is a perfect example. And you know, you've been training really hard, you've been learning all these skills, and then you see Dot across the room. And that was one of the biggest pivotal moments in your entire career. And you just said to yourself, I'm not going to let this happen again. Tell the story with who was Dot?
Yeah, so you had to bring that up. It still rips the heart out of me.
It's a great story, though, because everybody can see themselves in that.
It's true. So I had probably been in practice about 5 years at that time, and I was having some pretty good success. I'd gone through all the academy classes twice and been down to the Pankey Institute. Dawson didn't have hands-on at that time. So really, I probably spent $100,000 on CE in 5 years, did some MISH classes, and I mean, I was all in. And I still was in this little 750-square-foot office. I hadn't moved my office yet in Portsmouth. And I like to say I wasn't in the hood, but I could hear the gunfire. But I was doing some nice dentistry. By that time, I think we'd quadrupled the practice. And so we were doing really, really well. Well, there's this one patient named Dot, had a great family. I knew the husband better because he went to our church and they were different denominations. But Dot would come in and she literally had every surface of every tooth with a filling in it. So she was just patch, 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 patch. And so she typically didn't come in for hygiene. She would come in with something missing from the tooth. And I would look in her mouth and I would talk to her about needing mounted models and blah, blah, blah. I was telling her all this stuff that she didn't want to hear really. But I didn't have any way to hook her. I was trying to get her to accept records so I could do a treatment plan so I could fix her teeth. But I never really asked her what she wanted in hindsight. I never really connected with her. And she would sort of look at me and then she'd say, you know, can you just put some like epoxy back in there or something? So I'd eventually patch the tooth. And what would always get me is I'd patch the tooth and she'd look at it with the mirror and she'd give me a kiss on the cheek. She's this older lady. And she'd say, Dr. Cranham, you're such a good patcher. You know, it was just for me. I mean, she didn't realize it, but if she'd have just like stuck a knife in my heart, it would have been easier. So time went by and I probably patched her 6 or 8 times. And what happened was, it was Christmas Eve. We're Catholics, so we were at midnight mass. At the end of mass, we went into the little reception area, and Dot came over for that. She didn't go to mass, but she came over for that. And I saw her across the room, and her kind of back was turned to me. And as she turned around, I could tell instantly from her smile that she'd had a full mouth reconstruction. So I was shocked, and I said a few Hail Marys under my breath. I was like trying to calm myself down. But finally, I decided to learn something. So I'd walked over to her and I asked her, you know, I said, I noticed, and she wasn't at all embarrassed. She told me where she went and all about it and everything. And I finally just said, you know, the only question I have is, you know, we talked about getting that advanced, those models and stuff. I just was wondering why you didn't give me a chance at doing the work. And she looked horrified, embarrassed and horrified simultaneously. And she just very honestly said, well, Dr. Crano, I mean, you are such a good patcher. I didn't know you even knew how to do this kind of work.
Wow.
And so my realization that night was I'd spent $100,000 on education and I hadn't let anybody know. There was no evidence in my practice. I was trying to be humble about it. I thought it was professional. I thought somehow people would just be able to tell because my margins were better, my dentistry looked better. I mean, I was getting word of mouth, but I hadn't done a lick of marketing. And I had at that point several thousands of slides of my work, certainly hundreds of slides anyway. And, you know, at that point, I realized I needed to make sure everything in my practice was congruent with who I was becoming. Mm-hmm. And I realized that a lot of things, my waiting room had this end up furniture in it, and, you know, I hadn't changed anything about the practice. And so that's when I started to create the vision of moving, which didn't happen for maybe 3 years. But in the meantime, we did a facelift inside, and I created photo books. And something as simple as anytime I took a class, I had a frame at the front desk where they'd sign their checks about where I went and what I learned and how that was going to benefit the patients by having this additional knowledge. And so, yeah, I just did never want that to happen again. It's an important story because, you know, now almost routinely, almost weekly, there are patients that come to us from other practices in town that I know do nice work, maybe not exactly what we do, but still are capable of doing some things at a fairly high level. And they're leaving because they don't know that it's an option there. And so that's why I think that as we look at these patients that are more challenging, often it's those patients that have the want. These are patients that often want to have dentistry done at a high level. And they often, their perception is if things moving really fast, and there's no time to talk, and the dentist or the hygienist aren't explaining anything to them, that they don't fit there. And right. So I think there's a huge opportunity to build these workflows in the practice, celebrate the success, the outcomes of these workflows, and then market the success of those patients. And I think it becomes the key to what we do.
Yeah, I think that's the key because you used the word opportunity. You know, I can't imagine how that felt when Dot said that to you, but, you know, everybody has these in their career where you go, oh, damn it, I've worked so hard and I can't even believe a patient would say this to me. And then you just walk away with so much resolve saying, that's never going to happen again.
I don't even like thinking about it, but it was a pivotal moment. And I will say, I mean, we're in a situation now that we have a young doc in the practice and it's getting a little busier. We're building up the general side of our practice. So when my daughter comes out, and it's interesting, but there's always challenges. Wherever we are in our practice life, there are always these challenges. And it often comes down to, first, the clarity of vision of specifically what you're trying to create. And then secondly, focusing on the workflows that will allow for the best practice outcome. And what I find with dentists a lot of times is sometimes they visualize, but they just kind of hope it's going to happen by doing the same things over and over. Doesn't really work like that. And so, like, I think with anything, you're trying to create something, there's two ways to do this. You can do a bunch of trial and error and figure it out, or you can go and learn from people that are having the success that you want. And so, you know, that's why I went to the Dawson Academy and learned from Pete. I mean, why would I reinvent something that somebody spent his life developing? And I think that's why people come and train with us now. It's why they come to ACT Dental when they're trying to get the leadership and managerial piece. Dentistry has gotten so much more complex compared to when I started in 1988. I mean, I laugh about it, but I mean, when I got out, I had a pegboard. I mean, there's no computer in the entire office. And the young guy, what the hell is a pegboard? You know, but I mean, there was no computer. You pretty much, if you had a handpiece, a couple of burrs, and a mirror and explorer, you're ready to rock, man. That's all needed. There was no OSHA, there was no HIPAA. It's more complicated. So the more we can get really clear on what the outcome we want and then figuring out the workflow and get everybody trained on what they're supposed to be doing and really focusing on what the doctor actually needs to be doing. I love that slide that you show of the window, you know, that concept of the doctor staying in the window. And the truth is that we need to be diagnosis and treatment planning or doing dentistry and then doing big picture leadership stuff. We don't need to be caught in the weeds doing a lot of these other things. And I think if we do that, we can work a very comfortable 3.5-4 days a week and spend another half hour, another 4 hours or so leading the thing and in developing our team and make a lot of what I like to call enough.
Yeah. And you're at a stage now, too, where you're in the prime of your career. And I like to use the word joy. Like, you're doing what you've been trained for. You've prepared your whole life for this moment. So when these complex issues come into your office, these are challenging patients, no question. You got to sit down, you got to think. And diagnostically, your straight eight time is set up now where you have your think time. You can look at your monitors. You know what you're looking for, all that kind of stuff. What other challenges that you see with patients like this and how they can be keys to your success?
Well, I think the other thing, and we'll talk about both the two specialty patients. So we identify one specialty patient, and I like the green, yellow, red kind of concept. So the green light's sort of that general patient where we're going to work on their own habitual occlusion. The yellow patient is more problems with the teeth or the muscles where we're going to be redesigning the occlusion, but the joints are good. And then the red patient is the patient whose joints are changing, that are breaking down, or TMJ patients. So the yellow and red patients do require more diagnostic acumen. So in the workflow of after we get the data, so what we like to say is that if we identify these patients, however they're coming in, what we really need after that is sort of an advanced records visit. All right. So rather than trying to get all the data while they're there getting their teeth cleaned or they're there on emergency or however they came into the practice, having an advanced records visit is a key thing to keep in the schedule. So when the patient comes back for that, everybody on the team knows what they're going to be doing and why. So in our practice, that involves 21 photographs. It involves a face bow, some impressions. I'm going to have to do that more involved part of the exam, which might take me 10 or 15 minutes to really look at the joints, muscles, and teeth. And then I'll take a bite record. So that advanced records means it's the piece that's going to give me additional data. If it's a TMJ patient or an implant patient, we're also going to add a cone beam to that. So for doctors that don't have a cone beam, they just need to refer it out to get the cone beam, right, to their specialist or whatever. So after that advanced records visit, then the second thing that dentists always forget is that they now need time to treatment plan because right. The patient's not going to be there. And what we find is if they don't block the treatment planning time, it creates incredible stress because all of a sudden it'll be like Monday and they're at the end of the day and they're realizing at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, the patient's coming in for a consult and you haven't even mounted the models yet. So now all of a sudden you're there late mounting the models and you're tired and, you know. So this is the thing with these specialty patients that has to happen. Once you identify them, there needs to be an advanced records visit. Somebody needs to do the lab work. So there's got to be time to do the laboratory work, which, again, my assistants will schedule time for that. Mm-hmm. Then there has to be time for treatment planning. And then there has to be a consult appointment. So those four things in the workflow have to be done.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Because I do get this question. How long is the advanced records visit and what time of day?
So for me, it's a great transition for me, a transitional appointment between my specialty time and my aerobic time. So I really like to do it about in my straight eight, about patient comes around 11:30. So they're usually there about maybe an hour and 15 minutes. But if they come in and my assistants start the pictures and get the face bow and get the impressions, then I can come in maybe 10 after 12 and do my 20 to 25 minutes. Then after that, 12:30-ish is when I start my aerobic time.
Okay. Perfect little break for you and you're in it. You're fully engaged. Most things are done before you get in there, though. I mean, you're just making a connection with the patient mostly.
Yeah, reconnecting. And so typically, too, that there may have been a discussion, a little talk with my We'll get to that in a second. But yeah, typically what I'm focused on is my part of the exam. So in that advanced records, we like our hygienists to come in and do the probing. So they're doing the probing. So I like everybody to sort of try to touch that patient when they're there. It's impressive to them. And it's finely tuned machine.
Yeah. And now I wanted to say one thing too, because you haven't mentioned this. One of the things you taught me years ago was, you know, it's kind of overwhelming when you think about all the things that you do. It's very easy for a dentist's brain to get into the data. You know, these are very critical appointments when you're dealing with challenging patients, but really the essence of this is connection. So you want to be able to gather the data, but in the back of your mind or at the forefront of your brain, because you see a lot of dentists who do this, they get so into the data and they're doing it while the patient's there. You really, it's about connection first, data second.
So a good way to think about it with a general patient is a general patient, you pretty much usually have the ability to explain the problem and the solution at the same visit, because you're just building teeth back where they were. So if they break the tooth, there's no occlusal disease, and you think it's the filling that caused it, say, Mrs. Jones, the tooth was just weak, so we're going to fix this by putting a crown on the tooth. Next appointment's the crown, right? If you look in there and they've broken the tooth and there's a lot of other functional issues going on, like there's wear and teeth are loose and the muscles are sore, what we would say is, well, we're going to fix the tooth today with something provisional. But what we have to figure out is why this tooth is breaking, why you have this wear, why are these teeth loose? This is evidence that you've got something more globally going on.
Right.
So what's really important with specialty patients is to understand that your goal at the initial touch and at the specialty visit is just get patients to understand the problem and to understand the implication of the problem. So, you know, what I want patients to be asking something is things like, well, if we don't fix this, what's going to happen? Or how are we going to fix this? And often what I'll say is, well, that's why we're doing this extra data, because we have to start looking at the forces more closely on your teeth and figure out why these teeth are wearing. And what I'll often say is, what we know for sure is if it keeps wearing like this, you may not meet your goal of keeping your teeth the rest of your life. And so functionally, there is a normal amount of wear that should be happening. If wear gets into Denton, wear is now 7 times faster. And so we have to start giving them some metrics about the implication of the functional problem. I think dentists are really good at that with biologic problems because we're used to talking about it. We're used to talking about cavities and gum disease, but we got to get better talking about these functional concerns. And if somebody's driven by aesthetics, what we basically say is, this isn't just about the procedure. We're going to figure out specifically what's wrong with your smile. And we have a very specific metric we go through, and we'll tell them about our Dawson Diagnostic Wizard that we'll be showing them some keys of specifically how we're going to change their smile. So you're exactly right, Kirk. I think that at that advanced records visit, there's got to be data collection, but a big part of what we do is then summarize what's going on in their mouth, specifically how they're departing from what is normal and the evidence of occlusal disease, and then the implication of that. What is going to happen if this problem is not solved?
Right. And your diagnostic wizard, we'll talk about in a little bit, is just perfect because it's set up where you can give your best energy things that matter most, which is the connection, and let the wizard do a lot of the work.
It automates the workflow. It forces dentists to stay on the workflow. So.
And we love the word automation. So go back to the stoplight system, because I think what's really important here is you have a nomenclature or an identification system. Because even if you're a team member and you're watching this, you go, Dr. Cranham, that sounds great. But a lot of us as team members, we don't know how to classify these patients. And so you guys do it. You use the stoplight system for each one of these classifications. So the team members know exactly where to go. They know what needs to be done. And you're all on the same page, correct? Is that how you use it?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, sometimes in the course of the examination, you might even find patients are more involved than you originally thought. So maybe you see a lot of wear and tear on the teeth, and you originally think that the wear and tear is the only thing that's going on. But then you do your history and your load test, and you realize they also have a joint issue. Well, our team members know as soon as we're checking the box for a potentially displaced disc or something, degeneration of the joint, well, they know that we're going to get a cone beam. Right. So they know the data that I'm going to need. The other thing that I like about the concept of having that advanced records visit is that when somebody comes into the practice, we can have one standard exam that we're going to do. So we don't have to try to quote a zillion fees. But what we've trained our team members to do is that let them know that based on the initial screening, there may be some additional tests that we will recommend. And if we recommend, we'll explain to them what that is and cost. And we're not going to do any of that without their full permission. And patients get that. I mean, patients get, when they go to the physician does an exam, and then based on the exam, they might want you to go have a treadmill or blood, you know, I mean, that's kind of how it is. But you're right. I mean, if you really think about what we're doing, is there's really three workflows. It's not like rocket science. It's three workflows. And so as long as we, in that beginning, identify what channel they go into, then everybody knows what's going on. And then the most important thing, I think, too, is making sure your team members are then going to be appropriately trained and feel supported when they're put into a role to do some of these things. One of my favorite things that happened in my practice, it wasn't favorite at the time, but I had one specific person with me named Mariah for probably 10 years who did all my advanced records with me. And some things went on with her life, and she'd always, unbeknownst to me, thought about being a nurse. And she got to this point in her life where she was thinking about stopping dentistry after 10 years and going to nursing school. And I could sense something was happening with her, nothing with her work, but I could just sense something was a little different. So December 23rd, we were getting ready to go on break for Christmas. And I knew she wanted to talk to me. And I was trying to just finish what I was doing and slip out the back door before she could get me. So I literally had my hand on the back door when she's like, Dr. Cranham, can I talk to you for a minute? And I just looked at her. I said, do we have to do that? And so she's like, yeah. And so she shut the door, she kind of starts crying and tells me this whole thing. And I've always been a believer never to stand anybody's way, but this was a tough one because I think she had taken every photograph in my practice for like a decade, probably talking close to a million pictures. I mean, it's think about it. Yeah. So I'm hugging her, telling her it's going to be okay and good for you. Congratulations. And I was like slitting my wrists behind her back because I'm thinking I'm really in trouble. But she was so classy that she didn't start nursing school till September. And so she's giving plenty of time. And she's, look, I got this. We're going to train people, and we're going to train two people this time. And you know, within about 8 weeks, we'd identified people and put through training. And I couldn't tell whether Kristen or Brandy or Mariah were taking the photographs. And my models were still mounted and looked nice. So what that taught me was these skills, these workflow things are learnable, right? They're learnable by competent people. And I think one of the things that as a dentist that we have to get over, and it took me a long time to get over this, is we have to let go of things we need to let go. I say it all the time. If you want to have great pictures in your practice, you'd fire the dentist as the photographer. You don't be needing to mount models. We need to take the bites, but we don't need to be doing the laboratory work. But the thing that we do have to on all these workflows is we have to be the keeper of the standard. We don't have to be jerks about it, but we have to nicely let people know when it starts to get below the standard and figure out, is this person just lazy or is there something going on in the system where they don't have enough time? But we have to be the keeper of the standard and make sure that the system is going to be set up so everybody can do their best. And you know what I find is the best people want to do their best. So it's very motivational for them to be a part of these more complex things when they understand that the data that they're collecting is how we're making the decisions to do all this cool stuff. It's hugely important. So I think it also really prevent some of the boredom that can start to happen. If assistant, all they're doing is suck and spit all day, they need to have more than that. If this is going to be their career, they need to have more than that.
Yeah. So I want to go back to that because I think what you're saying is absolutely true. If you're watching this and you have great team members, they do want to be their best. And as a leader, as the owner of the business, you have to give them the opportunity. You got to give them a chance to win. If they want to take a course and learn more about how to be a better assistant, you can't stand in their way. You've got to fortify that journey. So that's critically important. The other thing that you said keeper of the standard. Now that's huge because What we don't understand sometimes is if we don't keep the standard, we live in the gap of that discrepancy. Do you know what I mean? So like if you don't keep
the standard. Which we call unpredictability.
That's right. Right. And you wear it in the form of the vein coming out of your neck because And everyone thinks you're a jerk and you bottle it up. Well, the fact is you weren't clear enough to say, look, the risotto, if this is a restaurant, has to be done this way in order for this entire experience. It can't go to the table cold. And so that's critically, critically important. Now, the other thing, I just want to say this, because if you're watching this and you see the mind of a master restorative dentist, this isn't always about great dentistry. Let's take the side as a patient. As a patient, if I'm in this practice, I'm seeing a lot of confidence. You know, the team members all know the stoplight system. I'm getting communicated with a lot of clinical competency, a lot of behavioral competency. It's just exuding confidence because you guys have had this repetition and the workflow. So it's mutually beneficial in a way that you could probably never even really get our arms around, because the patients, they say yes to people that they believe in. And so you've positioned yourself by doing all this that you are now the person that people believe in you when they write you a check. Well, people don't write checks anymore. They just put it on my credit card. And so it's important to understand both of those.
We take checks too, though. So
you do?
We take checks too. Yeah. No, I love what you're saying. And again, one of the most powerful things that we say, and Sarah, who does my sort of does the financial part of after the discussion, she's in there with a lot of these consults, and also when I'm meeting the patients for the first time. But there is so much power, and when somebody's telling their story, whether they're, you know, some TMJ patient that's been bounced around or somebody that's got failing restorative work, for me to be able to lean forward and just kind of put my hand on their shoulder and just say, you know, this is what we do. And again, a lot of times when there have been other places where they don't even have enough time to tell their story, and just by telling the story, they can tell by the dentist is getting stressed just hearing the story. But when we have time to hear it and listen to it and lean forward and say, look, this is what we do. We got it. That doesn't happen by baloney, right? I mean, right. Happens because usually there's enough clinical experience and commitment to our workflow that we've heard enough stories that I almost know from the history where it's going to go, almost. Now, again, I didn't land being able to do that, right? Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, you have to still set up the environment, though, where people can tell the story and that you've got a workflow for the data. And you're exactly right. Even in the beginning, when the patient all of a sudden is put into a place, we got to find out why your teeth are wearing and we're going to do X, Y, and Z. That's way different than anything else they've experienced going from practice to practice to practice. Right. So it is vitally important that that's where you start spending the time, is getting those pieces of the puzzle in place. First, recognize there are these different populations of patients, recognizing that you've got to add some of these workflows in the environment of what you're doing. And then really in no time, you start having successful, marketable patient outcomes.
Yeah. And now no time, I want you to define no time, because I've heard you say this and I've also heard Dr. Dawson say this. It takes 5 to 7 years to become an overnight success. So as a young restorative dentist, you might be watching this going, oh yeah, I want this, but you got to be patient with yourself because this isn't going to happen in a week. Yeah. It's not going to happen in 2 weeks, but you get to the 5 to 7 years, that'll go by fast and you go, wow, look at this.
I look at our core curriculum now as basically 7 touches or 7 classes. And we're seeing doctors go through it in about 18 months. And what we find is usually within about halfway through that journey, they already have all the pieces in place to start at least having the workflows in place to be able to start making some of these really good decisions. And so I would say it takes 5 to 7 years before the phone starts ringing, asking for specific things. But what people forget is these specialty things are right there in their practice. Right. When I was there on Airline Boulevard in Portsmouth in the beginning, I was a long way from anybody driving to me, but I had a lot of patients in my practice that had these issues that I could start right there. And so, you know, if you think about that, if you start putting these workflows in place to be able to solve more complex problems, well, you can invite patient into a specialty workflow from hygiene.
Right.
So if all of a sudden you take some training and you recognize, holy smokes, there's more wear here than I mentioned, a lot of us stress out about that because we're kind of like saying, I didn't say this last time, so how do I bring it up now? Well, you bring it up by saying, you know, one of the things I want you to know about is I've been taking a lot of extra training, understanding of diseases that can affect your bite or affect your joints. And one of the things that's happening in dentistry right now is we're going beyond problems just that are caused by bacteria. And as you age, you're going to be living much longer than your parents did and keeping your teeth. And so one of the things we're really focused on now is whether your teeth are going to make it that long. And I'm seeing some things here that concern me a little bit. And what I would like to do is bring you back and take a closer look and study your bite a little more carefully. And that's a wonderful way to do it. I mean, that's how I got started, was really inviting my existing population back. Or if a patient is in the crown of the month club and you've done a bunch of crowns in their own bite and they're breaking porcelain, well, don't keep doing that. You know, bring them back and ask why. I find patients then start going, wow, this guy or gal is committed. They're learning. They're taking classes. I'm at the right place. Yeah. You can spin that around. Pete always says Ford never apologizes for last year's model.
I love that.
I think everybody knows it's called practice for a reason. We get better every year. And that's one of the great things about being a dentist.
Yeah. Well, if I'm a dentist and I want more practice, I mean, really, Pete said this a long time ago. He said, hey, look, the one thing I would tell you is never say you have it all figured out. You're on a constant journey of learning. It keeps you engaged, keeps you excited. Where would I start, John? So, because I'm going to just throw the questions at you that I get. I think the Dawson Academy is a must. People have to go. But one of the questions we get all the time is, do I have to start at the beginning? Like, I've already done a lot of, so if I'm watching this and I'm a new dentist to get this training, where do I start? Or if I'm an advanced dentist, where
do I start? Yeah, let's talk about that. So I think that if you're a new dentist and you're wanting to install these workflows and you're pretty much, you know, kind of comfortable with the general dentist thing, doing things in maximal cuspation, and you're good at the nuts and bolts, then start at the beginning. You know, start with our seminar one. And seminar one is available online. Our next live class is in your neck of the woods in Chicagoland, I believe in June. We'll have a website, or we'll have an email address for you to click on. Again, with our relationship with you, we're going to have a discount available for that if people want to come. The nice thing about seeing it live is we also give you access to the online version. So once they take it, then all the lecture is broken up into a bunch of segments so they can go back and get crystal clear. That class is really the foundation for understanding both how this masticatory system is designed to work, how it breaks down with its in dysfunction, and then also these workflows that we're talking about. So that's the place to start, and it's the first step in our curriculum. I think what separates us is we have multiple places in the U.S. and internationally where when the hands-on starts kicking in, we usually have a location to do a hands-on pretty close by. But that's what I would say. We have some doctors that maybe took Dr. Dawson's classes years ago, or maybe they've trained at some other institutions and feel like they've got some of the pieces there. What I would say is if they look at our core curriculum and don't feel like they need all of it and are interested in specific classes, it's very common for us to talk to them about where they've been and then create a customized package in terms of the pieces to get the salient points of what we do. I still am extremely proud of the time and effort and the detail we put in on really understanding occlusal disease and making sure dentists can both design things that are beautiful and design things that are going to be long lasting. And that's a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Now, if you're watching this, just look to the feed on the right. I think Joan or Greg put this in there. The Dawson Academy has the functional occlusion from TMJ to smile design. It is actually on June 9th and 10th in Chicago at the Omni. You can just click on that link. It is fantastic. You have to go. And then also too, you guys just don't do training. I mean, you have a couples retreat. You also do some other things. Like, there's a lot that you do that's other than just functional training.
Let's just say it this way. I think that a big part of what Dr. Dawson instilled in me as a very young dentist was the concept that a well-run practice can be our vehicle to a happy and balanced life. And right. So what you're going to find from all our faculty members is these are hardworking dentists that have very thriving practices, but also have time to teach. And you're going to find that they have phenomenal lives outside the practice. And just a little bit about me way back is that when I first heard Pete, I kind of grew up in a family that had a lot of money till I was about 11. And then my dad's business failed. And then we went through really tough times after that. And so I grew up as the youngest kid with a lot of financial stress in the house. And a lot of the things that I think what drove me to dentistry was through this little fly tying business I had and working, teaching sailing at the yacht club in town. A lot of my favorite people in the community were dentists, and I sold flies to them and taught their kids how to sail. And I liked their wives. I just liked the whole gig. And so I chose dentistry because I thought it was a vehicle to have a nice profession, but have a nice life. But when I heard Pete the first time, if he would have told me that I was going to have to work 15 hours a day, 6 days a week to do what he was doing, I'd have done it. I would have said, okay, that's what it takes. But that wasn't the message. The message was, look, you can put in 8 hours a day. You're going to have to study right now and work hard. But if you give me a few years here and we get this on the shelf, you know, you'll be able to work 8 hours a day, 3.5 days a week. I mean, it allowed me to build a seminar business on the side and, but still have an amazing relationship with my wife now, almost 30 years, and raise 3 great kids and have time to fish and do things I love to do. So beyond that, I do think that the core is a really important message now for dentists, particularly young mothers that are trying to, I mean, I just don't know how a young mom runs a practice and raises kids. And it's so challenging, but this is a vehicle that allows for that. But beyond that is also our advanced curriculum. So beyond the core, we have a class that we're coming out now on the All-on-4 sort of implants on the Dawson philosophy, a full arch class talking about raising vertical dimension and how to do it with transitional bonding. So if in challenging patients where patients can't write the big check, how do you sequence that? Witt, you had on a couple of weeks ago, phenomenal information he's providing on airway and the whole medical dental connection, and then the advanced TMD type situation that Drew Cobb is spearheaded, not only getting them stable, but how to restore those patients. There's a ton there. And more, we're building our Dawson On Demand library. And then the Dawson Diagnostic Wizard is our software that we're training our doctors on that, again, kind of holds the glue together that these workflows we're talking about.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah. You got to get on there. I mean, there's a lot of different options. There are some simple options if you want to just test it out. And then you could go for the advanced all access, which I highly recommend. So it's just fantastic. And John, what you're really talking about here too, and we'll kind of end on this, is that because you and I are going to do a lot of these, is, you know, there are dentists out there that fix teeth, and there are people that change lives. It's not that one is good or bad. We're talking about creating a whole different, another level of career and enjoying what you do in a way that you just look back and say, this was just an amazing life, not just an amazing journey in dentistry, but an amazing life also.
Yeah, I think the way to think about it, I remember reading Stephen Covey years ago, 7 Habits, and beginning with that end in mind. And I remember somewhere in the book, he asked the question, and you know, with your clients, when you're at the end of your career and they're all in the room, what do you want them saying about you? Changing people's lives. You know, I'm in it long enough now that I'm seeing grandchildren of people that I took out pediatric teeth on type. It's crazy, you know, but what happens is the longer you do it is the relationships with these people that you take care of become so special to you. And it's the spiritual reward that you're talking about. And that life-changing stuff, which is interesting, sometimes it's not the magnitude of the case that creates the biggest connection. And so I think the more that we can go through this and be predictive, be efficient, be profitable, but have time to love these people and take care of them, that's in the end what is in our heart and our soul. And then, as you said, there's going to be enough money to do things that you want to do. We'll never be Tiger Woods rich, but we'll have a lot of enough. And it's certainly been an amazing journey for me. So awesome for you to invite me on today and share a little bit. I look forward to doing a bunch of these.
Yeah, it's fun. And as you can see, this is the essence and the value of any friendship or mentorship, because I'll just say I'm just not that smart to figure any of this stuff out by myself. And you came into my life at a good time. Pete came into my life in a good time. And usually if you look back at your life, in critical moments, there's someone standing in the fork of the road going, no, go that way. Don't go this way. Go that way. And so I'm grateful for our friendship, brother. So thank you so much. Now, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, how can I get a hold of you?
So I'm happy to give my regular email out as well. I do think sometimes the perception is, because I'm busy with Dawson, that I won't lecture to a study club or anything like that. And a big part of what I do is bang the drum and go out and speak to state meetings and things. So the best thing to do is email directly at smiledoc. And I missed an E like 23 years ago. So it is S-M-I-L-D-O-C, S-M-I-L-D-O-C at AOL.com. So I get joked on about the AOL, but everybody knows it. So it's just sticking.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. If you're looking for a phenomenal speaker, this is your guy. So just keep that in mind. So, John, thank you so much. And if you're watching this, thank you for watching. I really appreciate it. All the links that we mentioned are going to be in the post here. If you have questions, please add them either during the show, when the show's almost over, or after the show, and we'll be sure to give you a thoughtful response, and we'll have John back on in future time. So until we see you again, thank you for watching. You guys have a great day. John, thanks, brother. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kirk.